Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to our half-year results. I guess it's only recently that we met everybody, so the way we intend to approach today is that Paul is going to walk you through the results and trading, and then I'll update you on the strategy leading into Q&A at the end. So, Paul, if you can take us through the results, please.
Yeah, absolutely. Good morning, everyone. If we start with headline group numbers for the half year and then jump into a little bit more detail to kind of bring those to life for you. So H1 saw a 25% increase in revenue for the group and a 7% reduction in EBITDA. So I guess very much a half of two quarters from a trading perspective. Q1 saw group revenues increase by 46%, which Q2 saw revenues decline across the group by 9%. EBITDA, again, Q1 for the group was 29% ahead of year on year, and Q2 49% reduction on Q2 2019. What drove that trading performance? So if we go to our corporate division, our core corporate division, which contributed 93% of revenue in the period, what you see there is you see a division which contributed 34% growth, but a 5% reduction in organic revenue growth across the half year. At the end of Q1, which was largely unimpacted by COVID-19, we were in a position where the corporate division was performing to plan. I expected to be sat here today where reporting to you that we were delivering double-digit organic growth for the half year. And then clearly, COVID impacted the back end of March and then Q2. And most notably for our corporate division, our revenues, or 60 to 70% of our corporate revenues, are attached to the consumption of our energy consumers. Our clients. And what we saw in Q2 was a material reduction in industrial and commercial energy consumption. So across the quarter as a whole, we saw a 23% average reduction in industrial and commercial consumption, which tracks to what we've seen across our own portfolio, which resulted in, across the half year as a whole, a 5% reduction in organic revenue. The SME division was materially impacted as well in Q2. Operating a medium-sized call center is pretty difficult remotely. So we saw that division reduce its revenues half year to 1.9 million versus 2.8 in H1 2019. And in turn, EBITDA fell by £1 million H1 19 to £500,000 in H2 20. What you will note from the trading performance in the first half of the year is the robustness of the cash performance. So we've always pointed to the cash generation of the business. If we're not growing and deploying working capital to facilitate the growth, we always point to the fact that cash generation will be circa 100%. We actually report cash generation in excess of 100% for the first half of the year, which is driven by some of the actions that we took from VAT deferral in line with the government scheme, and also the deferral of PYE payments in Q2, which have been subsequently paid post-period end. So as we sit here today, we are now up to date in terms of PYE and NI payments. What you will also note is the growth in order book. So the order book in H1 didn't benefit from any M&A activity. So you'll note there's no, we completed a transaction post-period end, but we didn't complete any transactions H1. Which meant that growth in order book from 61.5 million at the period end from 57.5 at the start of the period is purely organic growth driven by new customer wins and the continuing to renew and maintain our existing customer base. You'll also note that post-period end, there was obviously the equity raise and the placing and the completion of the acquisition of Ignite, which led to a significant reduction in net debt and deleveraging of the group. So net debt at the end of August sat at 12.5 million. That was versus the period end position of 33.5 million. We, as Mark will run you through in terms of strategy, we remain on target to deploy that capital into the M&A opportunities that we believe exist in this existing market. The other point to is, well, what does that mean for the future? So you'll note that we're pleased to have reissued guidance this morning, having withdrawn guidance earlier in the year due to the lack of visibility. As we sit here today, the latest data we have from a consumption perspective is July, which points to a 15% reduction in industrial and commercial consumption year on year. So in terms of the guidance and bridging from the expectation that was in the market for FY21, pre-COVID to post-COVID, the key components of that, if I just break those down, the ongoing impact of consumption in our corporate division reduces EPS by 0.4 or EPS expectation by 0.4 in FY21. And that's an assumption, as I say, very much a conservative assumption that what we saw in July will continue throughout FY21. So you'd like to think, as we sit here today, there's upside in that position. But clearly, the sensible thing to do at this moment in time is take a prudent and conservative approach to expectations for FY21. You'll also note that the dilution from the fundraise contributes a 0.5 reduction in EPS. But of course, the upside of that will come when we deploy that capital into earnings-enhancing acquisitions. We've completed one acquisition, which Mark will run you through, being LSI, post the fundraise. And we continue to maintain an active pipeline and look to execute the M&A opportunities in the near term. I guess the other points to mention, the ongoing disruptions to the SME division, which we anticipate that the SME division won't bounce back to FY19 levels in FY21, causes a 0.1 reduction in EPS. And then I guess a positive impact to EPS from where we were pre-COVID is a 0.3 increase as a result of now owning 100% of Ignite, and therefore the minority interest that was there before, which quantified to kind of 0.3. We now see the benefit of that in the EPS number. So that bridges us from a previous expectation of EPS in FY21 of 2p per share through to now 1.3p. But as I say, it's very much positioned with upside in mind. It's conservative and prudent, which very much seems the correct approach in the current situation with the remaining uncertainty. I guess just to emphasize further our confidence moving forward, you'll note that we've reinstated our dividend. We intend to pay a interim dividend of 0.1p per share, payable in December, being the interim 2020 dividend, noting that we decided to defer the declaration of the FY19 dividend, which ordinarily would have been payable in July 2020. So the declaration of the dividend very much emphasises our confidence in the cash performance, which remained robust, as I say, during H1, but also the potential upside as we enter FY21 and emerge, hopefully, from the economic uncertainty that we all find ourselves in today. So if I hand over to Mark to continue with to run you through the strategy and the look forward.
So I guess from a strategic point of view, what I hope people start to take away from the way we approach the business is that we inform everybody what we're going to do. We focus on executing well, and we do what we say we're going to do. So ultimately, this business's its roots have always been in insurance services. And if to remind everybody, effectively what we do is we manage the energy cost equation for corporate consumers. And in managing that equation, there's a price side and there's a consumption side, and the assurance services are very much on the price side of that equation, where we help assure large corporate customers that they have bought professionally, that they have accounted properly, and that they have complied with their legal obligations. And the engine we've built there delivers 6-8% organic growth year on year. That's highly diligible. You can look at historical performance, and we have a 13% share of that assurance market. And for many years now, we've highlighted that as a highly fragmented market, and we are going to execute a consolidation thesis. When we came to do the placement, we did that on the basis that there was an acceleration in that opportunity to consolidate the assurance market. So effectively, we'd seen that M&A pipeline really develop and accelerate with motivated sellers, namely by the source of maybe aging entrepreneurs who were seeking to effectively not have to put more cash into their business because they got comfortable taking dividends out, and maybe they'd reached the point where that was enough given the current crisis. Or equally, you had professional investors who were potentially seeing their exit horizon being kicked out a couple of years and really looking to focus on different assets. So effectively, what we intend to do with this, and obviously having completed the first one post-placement, we kind of spoke to the market and said, look, we intend to do 3 to 5 acquisitions in H to 2020. And depending on what we execute there with the size of pipeline we've got, if we execute well, we would expect ourselves to move towards a 20% market share in that assurance space. That would make us the player of super scale in that space, with our nearest competitor being less than a quarter of our size. So from that point of view, you know, nothing's changed in the strategic thesis. We've executed well, and we will accelerate execution in line with the placing. Obviously, you can never say never with acquisitions, but ultimately, as we look forward, the kind of opportunities remain strong, and you know, we expect to deliver on that strategy. The other thing that we did back in 2017 is we recognized that we needed to manage the consumer's whole energy cost equation. So consumers don't really want you to solve half their problem. And from that point of view, Paul and I decided that we needed to increase the quality of our relationship with the customer. And you can recall that back at that time, we had 3 people pointed optimization services. We now have over 125. And in that regard, Ignite was being a key acquisition to really accelerate our ability to deliver optimization services to consumers. And that's really played as well to the evolution of the net zero carbon agenda, where ultimately I'd like to say that was part of some master plan. It really wasn't. We decided we want to have a better quality relationship with the customer. The market's come in our favor now with demand for net zero carbon services. But what we observe is that we now, through the actions we took a couple of years ago, have a business engine capable of delivering double-digit organic growth year in, year out. It was doing that in Q1. Clearly, COVID's affected that. But as that COVID situation unwinds, where we sit here having executed a strategy which allows us to have that machine in place. And we will continue to do that and deliver that organic growth into the future. What a lot of people haven't paid attention to is that at the same time as we informed the market that we would start to develop a thesis with respect to optimization services, we also acquired SystemsLink. And at that time, we said that we will also start to create a software solutions division, noting that SystemsLink at that time was serving around about circa 25 of our competitors, other businesses that provide energy assurance services to businesses. We've gone about our work quietly, and we've put a sales team into that organization. We've professionalized its deployment capability, and over the course of the last couple of years, we've increased the number of businesses that provide services in the same way as we do to energy consumers from 25 to 44. So we've increased it by 19. And the great thing about that business is a pay-per-meter model. So effectively, as those businesses are successful, the software solutions division is successful. And we've done that without deploying any new technology. You'll also recall that last year we took everyone through the idea that we were taking our capital investment in technology We'd completed our inward-looking actions, and we were going to start to focus on external-looking technology, which would really start to deliver new solutions to the marketplace. Again, we've done our work, and ultimately in October, the first deployment of that software will come to the market. As that software comes to the market, we expect an acceleration from the software solutions division, and ultimately that currently has, via competing organizations, a 5% share of the insurance market, and we would expect organically over the next 2-3 years to move that to a 15% share. And that really also plays to the idea that, having executed our consolidation thesis from assurance services, we really see ourselves in the position of focusing on organic growth across assurance from the software solutions division into the future. The final thing we've been really working on, and I guess we always try and tell, like we did 2 years ago when we informed the market of our intention to deliver optimization services, and we informed the market of our intention to deliver software solutions, we always try and let everyone know what we're doing next. Now, just as the net zero carbon agenda has really started to gain traction, the reality is that net zero carbon is only one part of the equation. And ultimately, the ESG wheel shows us that in order to deliver net zero carbon, we also have to solve the poverty paradox. And that really speaks to the idea that if we look at the wealthy in society, they've long since outsourced their wealth management to fund managers, to private equity companies, to wealth managers. And around about 2 years ago, we observed that the wealthy perhaps have also started outsourcing their social conscience. The mechanism of choice for doing that has been the ESG wheel. And what we observe is that, and what we like about it is that it recognizes that you can only solve sustainability issues, deliver net zero carbon, if you solve the poverty paradox. And the poverty paradox, namely, being that whilst we've got kind of lots of people busy creating a sense of awareness that we have a climate emergency, that you need net zero carbon, ultimately in the world, there's 7.8 billion people, and 5.8 billion of those earn less than $10 a day. And ultimately, they'd really rather just start to get out of poverty. The paradox being that as they get out of poverty, ultimately they consume more carbon or emit more carbon. When you do the maths looking at the World Bank data, the World Bank data will tell you that if you just extrapolate out for life expectancy increases to 2050, and you extrapolate out the idea that low-income countries and lower middle-income countries just move up a notch on the income ladder, effectively that increases the climate problem by 79%. So ultimately, we're not just all dealing with the problem that we have today. We're dealing with a problem that's 79% bigger. And I was speaking at an ESG conference yesterday where we started to work through some of those things. Now, what's really interesting is the sustainable finance disclosure regulations, which are set to come into force in March, really start to drive behaviours with respect to disclosures in this regard. And what we observe is that the solutions that businesses need, and we're taking a business up approach, not a fund down approach to this. The solutions that businesses need are really related to needing to provide assurance that they've actually complied with their ESG scores, that they've made the right disclosures. And this looks exactly like the energy markets, the energy advisory markets 20 years ago when I started as an entrepreneur. So what we've done is we've looked at the kind of opportunity here. We've started to make an organic entry into this market. We've made our first four hires. We expect to deploy around about £500,000 in relation to entering this market to really take advantage of the blue ocean opportunity that we believe exists with respect to ESG solutions. And as we layer that strategy on, what we expect to be able to do is update you over the next couple of years as to how that strategy is evolving, recognizing it's new, recognizing it's embryonic, but it's something that really increases the surface area of opportunity for the Inspired group of companies. If we then look at acquisitions, obviously we completed the acquisition of Ignite, and ultimately the opportunity there, we continue to like the way that business is performing. It was delivering 15% compound annual growth itself. And ultimately we have our first cross sell well in train now. We have second cross sell in trials, and also that business has won its first new major customer under our ownership since we actually completed the transaction back in August. As we said, a key part of the placement was to raise money to facilitate that acquisitive growth strategy to be able to actually deliver the acceleration of consolidation assurance services. We've done our first transaction post-placement, which is to LSI. That's been a kind of great acquisition in terms of giving us a business which has got a fantastic customer base. We need to give the business some kind of acceleration in relation to systems and to business process. But effectively, when we've completed our work there, we see an organization that should be delivering around about 2.5 million revenue and 700K EBITDA. What we like about the structure as well is that ultimately we're able to pay the contingent consideration based on realized cash. So from that point of view, it has a good structure for mitigating any unforeseen risks from the COVID situation. If we go to Outlook, what we can see ultimately is the business continues to prove resilient in the COVID environment. We're trading significantly above our downside case and delighted to be in a position where we can resume guidance and reinstate dividend, reflecting the confidence we have in the business. I think kind of the kind of reality in terms of Paul bridged you through the EPS, clearly we've been conservative basing things on the data we can see now, assuming the economy at some stage bounces back to consumption levels that we observed in 2019, then clearly that 0.4p of EPS, there's no reason why that shouldn't flow back in to the calculation just because of that kind of environmental consideration. Clearly we have no control over that, so prudent and conservative is the right way forward, but it's important to understand that that's based on the data we can see. I guess kind of the reinstated dividend again, giving us confidence in our growth opportunities. And then what we're really doing is we're focusing on delivering our thesis. Assurance services give you 6-8% organic growth. We've put the machinery in place to turn this business into a sustainable double-digit organic growth engine, which we believe will endure from 21 to 22 to 23. And ultimately deploying the capital raise during the fundraise to make us super scale in that sector, which we believe would give us a circa 2-year competitive advantage as other people try to gain scale. And then that evolution of the software solutions division, which ultimately, you know, we said we'd do that 2 years ago. We've now done what we've said we're going to do, and we're looking forward to seeing how that evolves. And finally, you know, you've got to be kind of blind not to have seen the ESG agenda and the increase in that opportunity. We look after 2,800 businesses in the UK market. If we execute our consolidation of the assurance service market, that should go up to closer to 3,800 businesses. And ultimately, they all have this ESG problem. There, to our mind, is not a solution out there for them. Currently, the solution that's required is almost identical to the solution that's required for energy. Just instead of managing the energy cost equation, you're managing the environmental cost equation, and then you're managing the ESG cost equation. We're very good at that, and ultimately we're quite excited by the surface area of that opportunity. That's the update from us. I guess we'll move to questions.
And we have a question from Andrew Nussey at Peel Hunt.
Just a couple of questions. First of all, you sound pretty confident, Mark, in sort of 3 to 5 deals through H2. I just wonder, to what extent is COVID-19 making the due diligence process harder or more lengthy? I'm thinking particularly in terms of understanding current trading and how that might impact the multiples that you pay, obviously noting how you structured LSI. And the second question, in relation to industry energy consumption, I just wonder, from your bottom-up perspective, when you look at your portfolio of clients, are there any particular or notable ones in there that might be giving you some cause for concern in terms of specific energy consumption? I appreciate you can't do it on a name basis, but any sort of insight you could provide there to the guidance would be helpful.
Sure. So, I mean, I guess kind of taking the acquisition point first, clearly, if we were acquiring something we didn't have a fairly good understanding of, I think you may well see an impact from COVID in terms of how do you get to the bottom of things. Clearly, all we're doing in the acceleration of the assurance market consolidation is really buying businesses which are carbon copies of our assurance businesses. So from that point of view, first of all, we've got some great benchmarks because we know our own business and we can benchmark against that. And secondly, I think we're up to transaction 18 now. And, you know, in terms of how that model works, in terms of how to unpick it and, if you like, re-sculpt the data to the way that we think of the model, we're relatively adept at. So from that point of view, I think in some ways, the kind of process for us of diligence of those deals hasn't really changed. Maybe it gets slightly more efficient because we don't all go visiting people so often. But the reality is that it's a mature process in our organization. You know, we've done it for many years, and ultimately I'd have more concern if it was something off piece, but as these are pure consolidation plays, no real impact. In terms of the consumption of the trading, so obviously we've gone through where the macro data is at, the 15% year-on-year reduction. We obviously sample our own book as well, and you know, we see broadly the same numbers. So effectively, there's literally, you know, not more than a 0.25% up and down as we kind of go through those kind of analytics from our own portfolio point of view. I think where you start to look at consumption being an issue, I think we mentioned before that the nice thing about our market is that whereas you'll have companies that you have in your kind of portfolios, or your investors have in their portfolios, which basically are very worried about, first of all, is the building open? Is it open for business? And then has it returned to previous utilization? Our equation's a bit easier. The question is, has the building open for business? Actually, it will use the same energy pretty much when one person utilizes the building or whether 100 people utilize the building. So from that point of view, we kind of see that we're not so worried or so sensitive to just how the economy bounces back, as long as the economy is open for business. The kind of logical conclusion of that, though, is that as the economy bounces back, it needs to stay open. So if you were looking at kind of areas of concern, it would be a case of, if you've got a business saying they've got 400 premises and they're closing 100, then that would have an impact on the consumption that we look after. I think kind of the other thing to note, though, in relation to the model that we operate in, is that the recovery of client fees, which are ostensibly quoted and sold on a fixed fee basis via the unit rate, is a custom and practice over the last 20 years in the industry, which evolved not being cognizant of the risk of a general shutdown of society. And so from that point of view, what I think you'll see is an evolution in the advisory model, because our work and the kind of value of our services to customers doesn't really change that much if their portfolio shrinks. Our work is the same at the moment. It's just an anomaly of the customer practice in the industry that says that we have this exposure to consumption. And I can imagine by the time you get through to kind of like 2022, 23, a lot of that will have unwound in the way the model works.
And now we'll go to Andy Bryant from Liberum. Any definite churn in half one?
So I guess kind of the reality from our perspective is, if we've been churned by impact on COVID and churning customers, there's been nothing, I would say, that's unusual from what we've normally seen. Paul, do you want to talk about debt and kind of issues there?
Yeah, so I guess in terms of significant customer losses, there's a couple of kind of corporate names, but it were kind of bought out of administration pretty quick afterwards, shortly afterwards. In terms of recoverability of our receivables balance in both divisions of the business, which is here today, we haven't seen a material change. You'll know per the numbers that have been published this morning, there's not a great movement in receivables or any difference to kind of normal levels. We note in, I think in my statement that that as of today, there's no material change in the recoverability either of the SME accrued income balance, but we do know that it's something we'll monitor. And clearly, I think we've touched on it previously, Andy, around, I think the impact to SME of COVID from a business failure perspective, but also, I guess, from an ongoing consumption perspective, will become more evident once the government schemes are lifted post-October. So at this stage, no additional provisions or changes to our balance sheet as a result, but we continue to monitor it through our H2.
Great, thank you. And Andy goes on to ask, if clients manage their premises and offices close, etc., over the next year, is that an advisory opportunity?
So it's interesting. So I think you get a number of pieces of incremental work from reopening a business or building through then to if one's closed and changing use. So I think one of the interesting things is that unless we expect space just not to be used, ultimately it will consume energy, and that's therefore there's a need for our service and there's an opportunity for us in that. So as long as there is some change and it just doesn't go to being derelict, then ultimately there may be some phasing, there may be some kind of volatility, but the reality is the need for our services and potentially the opportunity for more services during that transition is definitely there. What's really interesting is that when we see people starting to reimagine how they come back to work after the kind of crisis, and the fact that a lot of people are making that are really buying into the mantra of kind of making sure we come back better, if you like, we're seeing a lot more thought and opportunity in relation to how do we come back and do something that's going to make a difference from a net zero carbon perspective and a sustainability perspective. So overall, the best example we've got is if you look at the 2008 crisis, financial crisis, when people came back from that, businesses like Inspired were really considered part of the solution, and the kind of changes that are required tend to give us an opportunity to add value to our clients. We're expecting the same to occur as the society re-emerges from the COVID pandemic.
Thank you. And Andy goes on to ask, finally, your business and your customers' businesses will have gone through a rapid period of digitalization in the way you work. Do your target markets emerge from this working in a different way?
I think kind of there's inevitability that everyone's reviewing that, and there's some obvious ones in terms of professional services, anybody who's utilizing a office space. I think if you look at most of the surveys, and certainly back by our own survey, people who are working from home have got a strong preference to emerge to more flexible working. I think the figures are something like only 20% wanting to go full-time back to the office. So I think there's definitely going to be change in the way people work. I think kind of, again, the key thing is for everything that might change downwards, there seems to be something that's going to come upwards. So you, for example, if we believe more in the kind of online retail, the increase in warehousing, the increase in logistics for last mile delivery, all those things kind of create their own increase in demand, whereas you may end up with kind of reduced retail demand or kind of a reimagining of the way that retail space is used, which tends to move things more into the kind of cafe and kind of social business as opposed to a kind of a high street retail business. But again, we're going to see all those things emerge. And the nice thing about our business is that as long as they're using energy, there's a conversation to have. And our job is to make sure we remain relevant in relation to how those businesses are changing.
And we have another question from Andrew Nussey at Peel Hunt.
I guess to some extent it is following on from Andy Bryant's question, but when we look at optimization, what are the sort of the key end market targets now, and how has that evolved? Because obviously it was sort of multi-site retailers. And equally, in terms of the organic growth, sort of 12 to 15%, how are the competitive dynamics changing in that industry or that area? And are you seeing more entrants to try and target that growth?
The way the actual marketplace is evolving from a kind of customer point of view, for the optimization services, you start to see certainly a lot of drive into warehousing space and efficiency that's available there. Albeit, to be fair, the retail market is still very strong. So unless you've got a failing retailer, our experience at the moment is that the posture of the retail sector is to really make sure that they're driving every pound of value out of the buildings and the estate they've got. So to date, we haven't seen any change really. There's still kind of quite a strong drive from kind of estate intensive businesses, which can either be retail driven, can be hotels, can be property portfolio, student accommodation, all of those sorts of things. Anyone who's got a lots of units of consumption, that tends to be where the optimization focus is. We're not really seeing that go down so much, say for, we recognize if a business failed, there isn't an opportunity to sell there. But ultimately where we're seeing an increase is in the kind of warehousing and distribution side, where you seem to just have a lot of increase in intensity. And as that's becoming a bigger part of a business's, if you like, cost base, they're looking for opportunities to drive efficiencies there. We shouldn't also forget data centers. Data centers are a big customer group for us. And the reality there, of course, is that there's, I think pre-COVID, there was already strong demand. And the COVID pandemic and the drive to digitalization has only sought to really increase that. So, you know, kind of that's how we're seeing that evolve. And Andrew, just remind me the second part of the question.
It was just in terms of changing competitive dynamics. Are you sort of seeing, I mean, more people looking to attack that target market?
Sure. So I think the reality of that is it really plays to what we've said all along behind the rationale for our managing the entire cost equation and the kind of thesis we've executed. No doubt there'll be many companies trying to kind of get involved with we can deliver optimization services in this changing world for you. But as we observed previously, it's not so easy to walk up to a kind of major brand and say, hey, look, I'd like to do this for you. It's very hard to actually get that capital deployment decision when you don't provide the assurance services. So why this plays really well to us compared to any people who might try to kind of exploit that opportunity is that it's all about already being with the organization and adding value in relation to the assurance services. That makes it really a lot more straightforward to engage with them to deliver the right solutions for their business, as opposed to selling one flavor optimization service where I've got to find someone in the organization to engage with and then work my way up the decision-making train. We're already working with the customers at the top of the decision-making chain, and it's really about working with them collegiately to identify the best opportunities for their businesses. And you know, this has been a proven model from when I did my kind of private equity deals with the M&C Energy Group. We see that being a consistent thesis, and again, we expect that to only accelerate coming out of the crisis.
And that's the end of the questions. Mark, do you have any closing remarks?
First of all, guys, thanks for taking the time to kind of come and speak with us. I think, you know, from our side, we sit there and look at a situation where, you know, the start of the year, we were delivering to that our kind of thesis of double-digit organic. And ultimately, yes, COVID's been challenging, but we believe that the steps that we've taken are kind of pragmatic and prudent to deal with that. and ultimately, you know, as you see the confidence in the business from the reinstatement of dividend and the reinstatement of guidance, I guess what we're really looking now from our side is continuing to kind of do what we do, which is go out there, execute well, do what we say we're going to do, and deliver on the opportunities, which now lead us to start to focus on software and ESG as the future, whilst we execute on delivering the potential of the engine that we've created. Thank you for your time.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.